Could you please state your name?
My name is Rolf Slen.
What branch of the service?
I was in the Army Air Force.
Now, I don't know about your past, but can we start the interview by you telling me a little bit about your parents? What did they do?
My father was a lawyer in Madison, Minnesota. My mother was a housewife there. I spent all of my grade school and high school education in Madison, Minnesota, graduating from high school in 1942.
And what did you do after high school?
After I graduated from high school, I went to South Dakota and Nebraska and helped build barracks on two or three different bases for the Air Force.
Okay. Were your parents supportive when you decided to leave home to do that?
Oh, sure. I mean, I had finished high school, and this was summer, and I needed to earn some money for college. I knew I was going to go to college, and I did. After working that summer at these air bases, I went to started school at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, in September 1942.
And what did you study at St. Olaf?
Well, it was a general course. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but eventually I majored in history after the war.
So you didn't complete college before you entered the military?
No, no. I started in September of 1942, but technically enlisted in November of 1942. But I was able to finish that semester before I was called to go to Fort Snelling and then down to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri in 1st of February 1943.
What was your training at Fort Snelling like?
Oh, that was just a stopping spot. I didn't get any training there. I just went up there and immediately got on a train and went down to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri.
Okay, so that was the boot camp?
That was boot camp, yep.
What was that like?
Miserable. It was cold, it was dirty, and the first thing we heard when we got off the train down there was, quote, "You ain't gonna like it here," end quote. And we didn't.
How many weeks were you there?
Oh, I think maybe six or eight weeks, I don't remember. We cleaned latrines and we marched and we did all kinds of stuff in the mud and the cold. I can't remember that I learned very much there, but anyway, from there they sent us to Kansas City, Missouri for some college training in rudimentary college education in terms of meteorology. Even got a little smattering of military history and a little mathematics.
Was that a happier time?
Oh yeah, that was fun. That was hard work too. We did a lot of drilling there, close order drilling, but I enjoyed the educational part of it. Mm-hmm. And we had 10 hours of dual instruction in a Piper Cub because we were on the track to become members of a crew. So, but I washed out. I washed out of pilot training. I wasn't able to coordinate the hand and our hand and feet and so on in flying an airplane, and they just plain washed me out of pilot training. And that's when they put me on the course for navigation. And from there on, I was strictly going to be a navigator, and I enjoyed that much more than I would have enjoyed being a pilot.
Okay. What What was the first plane that you were introduced to?
Well, in Kansas City, Missouri, we flew in Piper Cubs. And later, during our training at these various bases in Texas, we flew in, I don't know what you call them, training planes of some kind, where we could practice our aerial gunnery and navigation.
For those of us who do not know, can you describe what a Piper Cub is?
Yeah, Piper Cub is simply a little single-engined, small airplane that beginning flyers always learn to fly in when they first get any training whatsoever.
How much training was spent on the Piper Cub?
Well, just those 10 hours before they washed me out, said I'd never make a pilot. So that's the only time I ever spent in the Piper Cub. So, I had never done any flying before I got into the service either, so I didn't know a thing about flying.
So what is the difference between being a pilot and a navigator?
Well, the pilot, of course, is the one in charge of flying the plane, mm-hmm. operating the rudders and the ailerons and taking off and landing, and he goes through an entirely different course of instruction than a navigator does. I eventually ended up in the navigation school in Hondo, Texas, H-O-N-D-O, Texas. That was 16 weeks of intense training in all aspects of navigation. And there are four kinds of navigation techniques that you learn. One is what we call pilotage, P-I-L-O-T-A-G-E. That's simply looking down from an airplane to something on the ground to see where you are. That's all that is. The other things we learned were what we call dead reckoning and celestial navigation and radio navigation. Celestial navigation was the most difficult. We had to learn the names of 55 different stars, and of course how to shoot the sun and the moon and carrying out navigation over areas where you couldn't see the ground. And that was very important out in the Central Pacific, because 95% of the time you were flying over water. There was nothing to look at down below, and you had to navigate by with your sextant, getting your location from the sun.
Interesting. I've never been told that before.
Now, the truth is, we didn't use a lot of that in the South Pacific. All of our missions were daylight missions, so obviously you couldn't see any stars,
sure.
And all you had was the sun. But the most important navigation technique was what we call dead reckoning. Dead reckoning is knowing the exact angle from the from due north from your place to the target, and the navigator would instruct the pilot what heading to take to get to that target, and then he would set his instruments on by those instructions. But of course, when you were over water, you had to determine how much you were drifting off course. You were always going to drift one way or the other because of wind. Mm-hmm. There's always wind, and the heading of the plane has to be adjusted to account for the wind, or you'll go way off course one way or another. So you had to read what you call drift off the ocean waves and, of course, inform the pilot about it so he knew how to direct the course of the plane in the right direction.
What was that like, learning all that? How did you manage? I mean, it just sounds so complicated.
Well, it was sort of intense training. I liked it. I thought it was very exciting and interesting. I enjoyed it. You learned all about these stars, mm-hmm. and you learned about how to use a sextant and shooting the sun, getting sun lines and lining them up maybe with a radio signal of some type. Today, you know, they don't have navigators on airplanes anymore because they have such sophisticated equipment that mm-hmm. there's nothing to it. But in those days, during World War II, especially over the Pacific, you had to be real careful. There were a lot of planes that were lost in the Pacific, not so much from combat as from getting off course and never finding your base.
And then where did you go from at this point, after this point, where did you go?
From
learning all the...
Oh, after navigation school.
Navigation school, yes.
Then I was commissioned as second lieutenant and I got a rest leave of 10 days to go home. And then...
What was that like, getting 10 days leave
to
go home?
Oh, that was great. That was the first time I'd been home since I left college for Jefferson Barracks, Missouri. So then I knew at that time I'd be going overseas. Mm-hmm. So after 10 days, then I went down to Arizona and joined was assigned to a crew down there. The crew consists of a pilot, a co-pilot, a bombardier, a navigator, front turret gunner, tail turret gunner, upper turret gunner, waist gunner, radio operator, and crew chief. There were 10 men on a B-24, and the belly turret gunner too. There were 10 of us anyway. And so then at that time, you see, we learned to fly as a crew. First time I'd ever met any of my crew members. And we got together and worked together very well.
Were you a cohesive unit then?
Yeah, very much so. My pilot was from Montgomery, Minnesota. My co-pilot from Superior, Wisconsin, bombardier from Rhode Island. The gunners were from various places, Florida, New Jersey, New Mexico. We worked together very well.
And now this was at base in Arizona, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And where did you go once you got your crew together?
Yeah, well, there we started flying practice missions and simulated bombing missions over various places in Arizona. Mm-hmm. Then we moved up to Boise, Idaho, and did some more training up there. And a lot of simulated bombing missions on the bombing range, artificial 100-pound bombs with nothing but sand in them. And from there, went to Kansas City, Missouri, at which point we flew to an air base near Sacramento, California. From Sacramento, California, then we took off across the Golden Gate Bridge down to Hawaii. And we spent another 5 months in Hawaii getting together with the entire group. I was with the 494th Bomb Group, which was the last bomb group to go over as a unit into a combat area. So we were one cohesive unit from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. We were not substitutes going over into different groups. Then in November 1944, we flew down to various islands in the Pacific and ended up, as I said earlier, in the Palau Islands, based on the southernmost island in the Palau Islands, a little island called Angaur, A-N-G-A-U-R. This island was about a mile long and half a mile wide. It had been taken away from the Japanese by the, I think it was the 81st Army Division. And there were still a few Japanese holdouts on one part of the island when we got down there, but they were guarded isolated pretty much by, I think, Marines. Anyway, we pitched our tents down there on this island and almost immediately started flying missions from there.
How long were you there?
We were there from November 1944 through June of 45. We flew a whole bunch of missions from there, most of them against the Philippine Islands. The Philippines at that time were occupied by the Japanese. So we bombed various Japanese bases in the Philippine Islands from November 1944 to, through June of 1945.
What was life like on those islands?
Well, believe it or not, it was kind of idyllic in a way. We were right on the shore of the ocean, and there was a nice lagoon right in front of our base, mm-hmm. Where we could go swimming, and really kind of neat. But of course, we were under pressure to fly missions every 3-4 days, and so it's a pretty tense situation.
What were those missions like?
Well, they were quite long, most of them. We flew missions against Corregidor Island in the Luzon in the Philippines, and I think maybe as many as 20 flights against these various bases that the Japanese held in the Philippines. And we'd always be met by flak, anti-aircraft fire on almost every mission, and sometimes by Japanese fighter planes that would attack our formations.
Sounds scary.
Well, it is scary because you're always afraid of getting killed or maimed or shot down or something, and some of our planes were shot down on these missions. So it was it's a very tense situation, but we worked together very well, and I was always very proud of the fact that no member of our crew ever failed to show up for a mission.
That's amazing. Tell us about some of the people you met while in the military. Any particular buddy stories that stand out?
Oh, I became very close to the pilot and co-pilot, maybe because they were from Minnesota and Wisconsin, so we were from a closely allied in that way. But my bombardier, who was from Rhode Island, the four of us, the pilot, co-pilot, myself, and the bombardier all lived in one tent. The six enlisted men, the gunners and so on, they lived in a tent of their own. Mm-hmm. So we became very close. I mean, we each had a cot in this one tent and lived together for months, mm-hmm. just the four of us. So, you know, you become very close to those people. And we had reunions after the war, too, and got together after the war.
So you went to reunions. Do you still talk to any of them?
Well, of the 10 men in my crew, six are dead. There are four of us left. I'm going to go out and see my front turret gunner next year out in Visalia, California.
That's wonderful.
He's still in good health.
Amazing.
My co-pilot, who I think I was probably closer to than any of them, is in a Alzheimer's unit down in Florida. Yeah, I went to visit him a year ago and he didn't know me anymore.
Oh, I'm
which
sorry.
Which is pretty sad.
Yeah.
And a radio operator lives in a little town near Atlanta. And I've seen him at a number of reunions.
That's great.
So,
how did you feel about leaving the military? And when did that occur?
Well, at the end of the war. Mm-hmm. Our obligation during the war was to fly 40 missions. Mm-hmm. We flew our 40th mission from Okinawa to Japan the day after the Japanese offered to surrender, but before the United States had accepted their surrender terms. So between the time the Japanese offered to surrender and the time the war was over, we flew our 40th mission. And there was no let-up of any kind until the United States accepted the Japanese offer to surrender. So it was kind of ironic. We didn't want to get killed after the Japanese had already offered to surrender, but we still had to fly that last mission. So as soon as we finished that last mission, 2 days later, the war was over. And because we had finished 40 missions, we were one of the first to go home.
Good for you.
And we flew down to Manila in the Philippines, and then took a boat, a Dutch boat. Took us 28 days to go from Manila to Seattle.
Wow.
The boat moved at about 15 miles an hour.
Wow.
We never saw land for 28 days, but we got back to Seattle in October of 1945. And the thing that I remember most about Seattle was landing there and seeing all the color.
Mm-hmm.
Red and white and blue. We'd never seen that for months and months. Everything was gray.
Mm-hmm.
All the gray uniforms so on. So that was the most... there were men there with red cheeks. And we all were sallow.
Mm-hmm.
Or brown.
Mm-hmm.
We had taken Adabrin to ward off malaria. And that gave our skin sort of a yellow cast. And that didn't go away for months afterward.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody got malaria.
That's great.
So
what was the feeling like being on that boat for 28 days, knowing you were going home? It was a long time on a boat, but you knew you were done with your your military service, what was that like? What was the sense of relief?
Yeah, it was totally different. The time that you felt this huge burden off your shoulder was when I was at an outdoor movie in Okinawa, and watching an outdoor movie, and I heard a lot of guns going off. And then in the background I heard someone saying, "The war is over, the war is over." And I couldn't believe it. The atom bomb had been dropped some days before that, and which we knew nothing about, of course.
Mm-hmm.
This was a huge sense of relief because we knew we'd probably live. So that was a huge sense of relief that we were going to go home and we'd be okay.
Mm-hmm. What did you do for 28 days, though, on that boat going home? Knowing that
books.
The worst was behind you.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a good feeling. Of course, we didn't know what it would be like when we got home. But I read books. I'd stand on the prow of the boat and watch the flying fish fly out. They'd go as much as 100 feet or more as the boat was plowing through the water. It was a Dutch ship with Dutch crew. The Dutch crew hadn't been home for 5 years.
Wow.
All during the war, the Nazis, you see, invaded Holland in 1940. And this crew was out in the ocean at the time, so they never went back. And they participated, of course, in the war effort, just like the rest of us. So I suppose they were anxious to get home, too.
I can't imagine. 5 years.
Those guys are gone 5 years.
Wow. Yeah. And how long a time had it been? How many years had it been for you?
We were overseas from November of 40, or June of 44 to August of 45, a little over a year.
Sure. Long time. Rolf, what did you do after you left the military?
Well, I went home during the fall of 45, and then I knew I wanted to finish St. Olaf College. So I went back to St. Olaf College starting in February 1946.
What was that like, going back to college after that?
Oh, that was good. There were other guys that had been in the service that I knew, and they came back too, so that was great. That was great.
And what degree did you walk away with from St. Olaf?
Well, it was a bachelor's degree, and I majored in history. Then I went to law school and spent 4 years in law school. And
where did you go to law school?
I went to Harvard Law School after St. Olaf and came back and joined a big law firm in Minneapolis for a couple of years and worked for the city attorney's office in Minneapolis for 2 years. Then I spent 7 years with the attorney general's office in St. Paul, assigned to the highway department.
Interesting.
And then went down to Albert Lea, Minnesota, and was there for 20 years before we moved up here to Fargo.
Do you have any stories that you'd like to tell before we close? Anything that stands out that you'd like us to know?
Oh, I've written up all those stories in my memoirs. And
that's great. And you wrote how many books?
Two.
Two memoirs.
Two different memoirs. I got all kinds of stories in there.
That's wonderful. It's a great keepsake for your family, too.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I thought they would enjoy it, and I think they did. And I thought I should contribute to the history of World War II by someone who knew something about
it. Who lived it. Absolutely. Yeah. That's terrific.
You see, we got back after the war, and it was impossible to talk to anyone who hadn't been in the war mm-hmm. about what we had done, because you didn't feel that they could possibly understand what it was like. Mm-hmm. Maybe they could, but we didn't feel. So I didn't talk about it for years and years until I wrote those memoirs. Mm-hmm. I might talk about it to those who had been through it, but sure. Not to others. My sister, younger sister, was always pestering me for telling me what happened. Then my dad finally told her, lay off, leave him alone. Mm-hmm. Don't ask him all these questions.
Did it take a while for you to want to talk about it and to finally put it on paper? Did it take a while?
Yeah, I didn't put it on paper until 1997.
Wow.
Which was some years after mm-hmm. the war ended. So. And I was glad I did, because mm-hmm. I felt better about it, but it's kind of difficult. To write it up, you had to relive the whole mm-hmm. thing again, and that was kind of difficult.
Difficult, but also maybe cathartic?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I think it was.
That's
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
Rolf, how would you like to be remembered?
As a veteran? Oh, I'd like to be remembered as a person that did his duty during World War II. I never thought that we were the, quote, the greatest generation, end quote, that Tom Brokaw talked about. I just thought of us as doing our duty and being proud of what we did, and then after the war was over, we just took up our lives and went on. You hear a lot about post-traumatic stress syndrome now. That was unheard of back in after World War II, but I suppose there were a lot of people that had that. I don't know. Maybe we all were. But it was one of the greatest experiences in my life, really was. I'll never forget it. Can't forget it. I mean, I shared that experience with 9 other men that I couldn't possibly share, and that they couldn't, that none of us were able to really explain very well to other people.
Thank you, Rolf.
You're welcome.